Welcome to the B-Side podcast with Towson Alliance Church. Tyler Crawford hosting here. As always, joined by our lead pastor, Steve Croker. And today we have a very special guest. We had talked about it last week on the podcast. I had hinted that we may have a special guest. I didn't tell you who it was in case you got a flat tire or decided you didn't want to come and visit us. But his name is Barton Parib, and he's a contributor at Grounded in the Gospel, which you may be familiar with that blog, as well as a pastor, and has just released a book called The Problem with Christianity. And we've invited him to join us on the podcast and just kind of walk through why he wrote the book. And we're going to walk through a few of those kind of the things in the book, the few of the problems. But Barton, thanks for coming. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and why you wrote this book.
Yeah, thanks, Tyler. Thanks, Steve. My name is Barton Parib. Good to be with you guys, hanging out.
Yeah.
I've been a pastor at Dunbar Heights Baptist Church for the last 13 years in Vancouver, right down by University of British Columbia. Before that, I was at Trinity Western University, worked there for 4 years. So it's been a lot of fun hanging out with a lot of university-age people. My church in Vancouver, the average age is 28, so we're a pretty young church, and a lot of people there kind of working on their degrees and stuff like that at UBC or at Regent, or they work downtown or things like that. So I just finished up at Dunbar Heights Baptist Church, actually literally on Sunday. And I got a little time off, and then in mid-August, I become the pastor of Central Baptist in Victoria. So we're making a move.
Is that another university-type campus?
No, it's right downtown, okay. Victoria. So if you've ever been down to the Empress Hotel or anything, yeah. You could walk over to the church. So kind of close to you, Vic, but it's not the average age is not 28.
Yeah.
That's pretty young for a church. Yeah. But
My last church's average age was like 88. So that's pretty good.
So a new posting coming up soon. Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, the book is called The Problem with Christianity, Six Unsettling Questions You Have Asked, essentially. That's exactly what it is. So essentially, what are the six questions that you find that people are having an issue that both believers and non-believers are saying, this is my issue with Christianity? And clearly that, when we hear that, we'll probably hear some of your motivation for why you wrote this
book. Yeah, let me explain the title just so people understand where I'm going with it. It arises out of just many, many conversations I've had. You know, you're sitting around a table like this. Maybe it's in a backyard. You're having a barbecue or something like that. Maybe you're sitting in a pub with some guys. Maybe you're on a university campus. Maybe it's in a question and answer after one of our services. And here's a common scenario that comes up all the time for me. The topic of Christianity comes up, and someone says, the problem with Christianity is, and then they fill in the blank for what they perceive to be the problem with Christianity. So I'm not necessarily saying there is a problem, just one problem with Christianity. I'm saying each person, as they think about the Christian faith, has a problem, a stumbling block, whether they're Christian or non-Christian.
Right.
So one of the great joys for me of hanging around people who are not shy about sharing their skepticism or their doubts as they talk about these kind of things. So I've had many, many conversations over the years as people just say, well, this is my problem. They would say it as, this is the problem. And for them, it's the major thing that keeps them from faith if they're not believers. And then if they're Christians and they're not shy in sharing their doubts, this is what they're saying. This is what I honestly really struggle with. I am a Christian, but here's something, if I'm really honest with you, this is an unsettling question that I ask. So the six topics or six problems kind of arose out of 17 years of discussions in all kinds of places, from coffee shops to campus life to all the things we just talked about.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I'm looking through your table of contents going like, I'm amazed that you're able to limit it to six.
That's exactly right.
I don't know if Steve, if you found that, but going like, oh, like, I'm surprised there's nothing in here about this issue issue.
Yeah,
like,
because right.
The things you hear, but, but you were, I heard you saying that you were talking, you wrote this thinking through, predominantly where we are, like in a Western culture, that it's not necessarily a global book, but, who did you write the book for?
Yeah, I tried to write it for anyone who has that problem, whether they're Christian or non-Christian. So it's not specifically aimed at a Christian audience. I would hope, actually, that Christians would give it to non-Christians. It's the kind of book I would really hope people would be comfortable as a non-Christian reading it. It's not a book that's going to be aggressive or something and something like that in your face as a non-Christian. You're just going to throw it away. I would hope that as a non-Christian reading it, they'd say, yeah, that is what I think. And then I hope they would feel challenged or they would feel encouraged or whatever by how I'm going to respond to what they're saying. So I try to represent the problems well in a way that people would say that's exactly how I would say it. But it is a very West Coast book. I suppose you could even say it's Western culture, but you know, friends of mine or family members even or you know, in Africa or in Southeast Asia, they, you know, this is not exactly the top six problems they have.
They have different.
And even I would probably say 10 years from now, this book will be maybe obsolete. There'll be totally different ones. And I would actually argue right now, I think there's probably 10 other ones I could have easily added. But it's 187 pages. I wanted to make it a manageable book. I wrote, was there 22 chapters in it, I think?
Readers of my ilk appreciate that.
Yeah, exactly.
So like, hey, I can read this.
It's 187 pages, but it's 22 chapters. So all the chapters are bite-sized. Yeah, I try to make them, you know, smaller. So I could have written 10 more problems, but then the book would have been 600 pages. And nobody would have bought it.
Well, you outlined six, and why don't we just present, Steve and I will present the problems that you suggest, and you can maybe try to just give us a quick overview. We'll grab some copies of this book for me to have available if people listening want to buy it.
Sure.
Right? Is that right, Steve?
Yeah.
And then, if you want to know more, you can find out in the book. But the first problem, not surprisingly, homosexuality and God. Why does God seem to be against gay people now, given where we are right now in history and what's gone on in the United States this last week? I'm not surprised that that's there. But what are you hearing? What's kind of included in that chapter?
The difficulty, obviously, in writing a shorter book like this, like we just mentioned, in shorter chapters, is this topic has so much in it that I had to limit myself to a specific question. So the question that I'm very specifically trying to address is God against gay people? Is God anti-gay?
Right.
So that feeling that God is against people is what I'm really trying to target here. There's so many other issues that come up with this whole topic that I don't address, and that's actually what hurts me most about the chapter is I'm like, oh, that needs to be said, that needs to be said. But I do try to make sure I deal well with that one question.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And so this kind of arose out of your own preaching and teaching. Hmm. What was the response to you kind of tackling this question? Hmm. How did people react to it, and what did they find helpful, or what did they find to struggle still with sort of the biblical teaching on explaining how God views homosexuality?
To directly answer your question, I think it went over very well. We had a lot of non-Christians who were part of this. We had question and answer periods after. A lot of people really, as non-Christians, expressed how appreciative they were to hear a bit more of this kind of perspective. Because I think as Christians, we've got to be careful when we're talking with people who are not believers. How do we present this topic? And my first sentence in the chapter is that the gay community has felt God is anti-gay because religious people often act in ways that are anti-gay.
Hmm.
And oftentimes, even right now, I think actually what bothers me in the way that Christians respond on Facebook right now to the whole thing in the United States is I see all these blog posts being linked, things like, 10 lies that the culture believes on homosexuality, or, you know, why everybody is wrong to make this decision. And perhaps those blogs are correct in what they're saying, but I'm not sure that's the first thing that needs to be said, and I'm not sure that's the main thing that needs to be said all the time. Yeah. There's a tone about it that I think drives a wedge that doesn't need to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so people who are not believers immediately feel God is anti-gay because, I mean, if you see a post that said 10 lies gay people believe, what does that say?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's a presentation thing, and it's also just where is your heart at in all this?
Yeah, and I mean, it's funny you mention that because I was having a conversation with somebody about that exact thing today about social media and how to, and I just said, like, no, I said to this guy, I challenged him by thinking, like, he was talking about, oh, how do I talk to people about this issue when all these people on Facebook are saying this? And I was like, who's not weighing in?
Mm-hmm.
Who are the people in your life that are you haven't seen say anything and are probably having those conversations privately instead of on a public forum?
Sure.
And it was just kind of, oh, right, yeah. And he was thinking of his pastors, his youth leaders. Like, these people they're not changing their profile picture. They're not giving one indication another way. They just want to have those conversations face-to-face. And I think we are a lot more a far better ear from people when we handle those issues in any. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not going to argue somebody into the kingdom or on these issues.
Well, it's just for me, it's if we're really people of grace. So this is the first chapter. I titled it, "The God Who's Radically Inclusive." And I think this is where we have to begin, is with God's inclusivity of the gay community. Not first of all saying God's against homosexuality or something. God, first of all, because every person is made in God's image, every person deserves respect, dignity. Every person has dignity and worth and value. That's where we must begin. That every single person is welcome at the foot of the cross. That no one is turned away if you will come to Christ. God is radically inclusive that kind of way. And I almost feel like as believers, we need to say it until we're blue in the face, because people, it takes a long time to get through that. Really, you are made in the image of God. You have worth and value, and God is not up there ready to throw a lightning bolt at you at this moment because, you know, of this one particular sin. Now you got to get right with Jesus. But we have to say that, and we have to be the first people who oppose violence, of course. Well, the first people who are against any forms of intolerance that are name-calling or bullying. This is all the things we need to say first. You'll only gain a hearing if they see the compassion that we have. Then in the second chapter, I deal with the God who revolutionizes identity. So I'm going to talk there about how our core identity is not our sexuality. Sexuality is a part of who we are. But I don't want to define anybody by their sexuality, as that is who you are. You are so much, you are worth so much more than that as a human being.
And I think that's a message that's not been said enough. And I've often, I think you and Steve and I have talked about it privately a lot. And I always feel like I'm talking about that with people, is that that's not my first identification, is that I'm a straight person. That's not the first thing I want.
Whether gay or straight,
that's
not your
first. Yeah, I want to be known by. Like, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a pastor, I'm a friend. Like, there's all these other things I'd rather be identified by, but I think we've, it's almost like, I wonder if how much of, we've just kind of pushed people into a corner that way. That sounds interesting and great for conversation, but why don't we keep moving through. The second problem you suggest is science and miracles. Another common one, not surprised. None of these should surprise us, I think. I'm sure we've heard them in some form or another, but why should I believe in miracles in an age of science? So how do you handle this question?
What I want to tackle here is, well, I'll set it up with a little story. I remember going out for to a pub one evening with a guy who just graduated from engineering at UBC, and you know, before the nachos even arrived, he began the conversation by saying, "Why should I believe in God when science explains everything?" And so that's how the and that's where we went for 3 hours. So that's why this chapter is so important. Why do I need God, or why would I even believe if science explains all things? And so what I tackle here are biases that are either for or against that make us think that way. This is the air that we breathe in this culture. It's the way that we're raised mentally. If you can't prove something empirically, it can't exist. This kind of a thing. So I first of all deal with our just our bias against the supernatural, and I show the difference between naturalism and supernatural. Naturalism, that the universe is a closed system in a box with no supernatural being outside of it. And supernaturalism, there is a God who exists within and outside of it. And try to show that the whole debate about miracles actually comes down to a bias against the existence of God. That's actually what the whole issue of miracles is. If God exists, it's perfectly plausible and it's perfectly possible that miracles exist. If you say miracles are impossible, then you must have an airtight case to prove that God does not exist. So we got to get down to that. It's actually not really about miracles. At the end of the day, it's does God exist? Because if he does, miracles are possible and plausible. So then I deal with another chapter on our bias towards scientism, which is this idea that science can explain everything. And I ask the question, can it really explain everything? And then I get into Christianity's biggest miracle claim, which is the resurrection of Jesus. And is that plausible to believe in modern times? Can we really believe that ancient people who tell us a guy rose from the dead is really the Son of God who ascended to God's right hand and this kind of stuff? Aren't ancient people, you know, ignorant? And we live in the 21st century and we have a more than a high school education. Can we really believe those kind of things anymore? So that's kind of where the chapters go for that question.
Oh, good. And then the next problem you raise is violence and God. Why should I worship a God who commanded genocide? And I've had people, remember a conversation with a guy in my office who raised that very question. Everything to him hinged on genocide in the Bible, and if God would, if the God of the Bible, who commanded his armies to go and wipe out the Canaanites, if that's true, it was sort of an all or nothing, and it rested on that one issue for him.
That's exactly it.
And he was well read on it,
yep.
But that was the thing that kind of broke everything for him, and so he just could not identify as a Christian. So, is that the sort of the idea of the problem there, and how have you kind of tackled it here?
That's exactly it. I don't think this is actually the most common problem people have, but I have found, in my experience, that like the story you just gave is perfect. The people who do know and think on this problem, it is the problem for them.
Yeah.
Because it shows, if that's true, then God is totally unjust. God is not worthy of worship. Why would I want to follow a God like that?
Mm-hmm.
So this one maybe is a bit more particular, but I think particularly the new atheists like Richard Dawkins and Hitchens post 9/11 world have really brought this to the forefront. So Dawkins calls God a moral monster. Hitchens gives these huge quotes about God's indiscriminate massacre and this ethnic cleansing. I mean, words like ethnic cleansing and genocide, those are massive words.
Yeah.
And so what I try to show in these chapters, without totally giving it away, is that this is not genocide actually at all. This has nothing to do with hatred against a certain ethnicity and race. And what I try to show is the entire Bible's backstory to this event. I really think a lot of people have an idea of what happened there, and they're, most of it's misinformed.
Yeah.
So I want to correct a lot of misinformation about what actually happened. And then I want to show archaeologically and historically what were the Canaanites like. Because we have this idea they're this idyllic, peaceful people.
Innocent.
And suddenly this massive army swept in and just slaughtered everybody. It's a total opposite story. And in fact, this is a brutal, oppressive empire. These are people, so I go through a lot of archaeological evidence on what kind of people they were as far as things like temple sex, the violence that they had, the child sacrifice that they did, their bestiality, all kinds of just evidence from history on this is a totally degenerate society that God had warned and warned for 700 years he had been patient with them. And then finally, the God of ultimate patience said, like any just judge, enough's enough. I have to do something eventually. I've been patient 700 years. Eventually, God, to be just, must act. So I'd point my readers a bit more to the evidence on this chapter because we can't really develop it too much here.
Yeah. Sounds interesting. I'm just flipping through, looking at the subheadings in the chapters going like, oh, well, I'm going to read that tonight. Like, this good, sounds good. Problem four, exclusivity and intolerance. I find as a youth pastor, that's one, that's probably the big one. Because I look at, and especially in the Lower Mainland, we have so many cultures kind of intersecting in the West Coast. With different spiritual beliefs, Buddhism, Hinduism, Sikhs, Muslims, and so on,
sure.
That, you know, and I mean, I think a lot of it is based, from my experience, on experience, that one student that I talked to had a experience with this person who seemed to, by their understanding, have this deep, meaningful relationship with it. So how can Jesus claim to be the only God when so-and-so over here has this deep connection with Allah or Buddha or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
So how, I guess, lack of better term, what angle did you take on that? Or I imagine that was a pretty prominent one dealing with you.
It is. I mean, it undergirds everything I write about in here is the pluralistic society we live in that you just mentioned. But I'm going to add a piece to that. And that piece is the accusation that if you believe in one way to God, that will lead you to be intolerant of other people.
Right.
So I think that's the big thing in our society is people say, well, I have my truth and you can have your truth. And we're all just going to get along fine. And so we're all tolerant. But if you believe there's only one way, then you are intolerant, and that's going to lead to not just intolerance, but even potentially to violence.
Hmm.
So I'm dealing here with the question of religious violence and intolerance because we believe in one way. And basically what I'm arguing in these chapters is that, contrary to what most people think, we are all exclusivists, every single one of us. It is not just Christians who are exclusivists. Everybody is. Every religion, first of all, is exclusive. Easiest example would be, you know, just take Islam, for instance. They do not believe that Jesus is the Son of God. They have a very particular view on that, and they say this is the truth. Well, that's an exclusive position. Hinduism, you know, that we're going to be reincarnated over and over again. That's a very exclusive position. Either we will or we won't. There's no
Yeah.
Middle ground on that.
Yeah.
You either are or you aren't.
Yeah.
Atheism is a very exclusive position. There either is a God or there is not a God. And I try to show that religions are exclusive and also secular people. And this is what's maybe the chapter that would be most mm-hmm. surprising is that secular people also make massive claims.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll just read one section for you quickly just to give you a flavor for the secular. This is on page 121. I call it the most exclusive secular claim there is. I say, after considering all that has been said in this chapter, many other secular people end up saying, well, I just don't believe absolute truth exists at all. I don't believe there is one truth that everyone must believe. People can believe whatever they want, as long as they don't hurt each other. Again, this sounds very humble and even noble, but such a statement is one of the biggest, most exclusive, inconsistent, and culturally narrow claims a person can make. It is a very big claim, first of all, because the person is saying, the one true thing in the universe I know for sure is that there is no truth. So that's why it's a very big claim. I know for sure there's no truth. Now here's why it's inconsistent. I write, it is inconsistent because in a right desire to forbid things like rape, the person then says there's at least one absolute truth everyone must follow, namely, that we do not hurt each other. Then I ask the question, if there is at least one absolute truth everyone must follow, then why can't there be more? Furthermore, this claim is extremely exclusive because the person is saying anyone who does believe in absolute truth is wrong. So you see how exclusive that is to say that.
Yeah.
If you believe in absolute truth, you're wrong. Well, you're the one being very exclusive. Mm-hmm. Finally, it is culturally narrow because virtually everyone in the history of the world and the vast majority of people alive today believe absolute truth exists. Try asserting the idea that there is no such thing as absolute truth in India, Africa, or the Middle East and see how people respond. We see then that the supposed inclusivity of this claim ends up being so drastically exclusive that it rejects almost every person alive on the planet today and the vast majority of people in history. It all comes down to this one point. We are all exclusivists. It is impossible not to be. Every time we claim something is true, we are, by definition, claiming that its opposite is false.
Huh.
And then I try to go show on how Christianity provides something very unique, which is that Jesus' exclusive claim has the power to make us humble, which I'm not sure that any other claim can make. So we all are exclusivists. We all make exclusive claims. The only question is, which claim will lead us to humility and to treating others with love and with tolerance?
I love that... How the rhetoric just falls apart, like when you really break it down. That's interesting, and I've always wondered how much of it is with that is like an authority issue. Is that when we claim exclusivity, we also have to put ourselves under authority of that exclusivity. Like if we're not exclusive to anything, then we're not bound by any of the authority of it. But
yeah.
Good. Problem number five that you bring up in the book is the problem of evil. And the question, if God is good, why is there so much evil in the world? And it seems like every week there's a new tragedy of the day that is on people's minds. Recently, the shooting in Charleston.
Yeah.
It doesn't take long for there to be another event where there's a school shooting or tragedy that happens in the world of various kinds. And so this comes up a lot of people.
Yeah.
What kind of objections do people have, and how did you try and touch on it in the book? It's a big question.
This is such a big question, and what's so hard about it is that it can be asked just purely on an intellectual level, but it's also maybe next to the homosexuality one as well, one of the most emotional ones.
Yeah.
Hmm. So I try to actually deal with both. That's my goal in the chapter, is to touch both the intellect and the emotions and show that I think Christianity has the most satisfying and intellectually credible answer of any worldview, of any system of thought, of any spirituality or religion or secularism or anything. That's a pretty big claim to make, but that's what I think Christianity offers here. And what I do is kind of track the theme of the kingdom of God in Scripture. I won't be able to unpack it in our short time here, but particularly I think as we get this concept, Christianity provides us very clear categories of good and evil, which not every other system of thought does.
Right.
Then it also says that it starts to provide us hope by saying, or maybe not hope would be the first word I'd use, clarity maybe in this world, that good and evil will exist in this world. In other words, we don't believe in some utopic dream where evil is going to cease to exist because we progress culturally or educationally or scientifically. We're not going to get to a place where you get utopia. Mm-hmm. But then the Christian message ultimately is one of great hope, that there will be a day when good will always exist, but evil will cease to exist. And in that chapter, I really try to show how emotionally satisfying the Christian answer is. It's actually my favorite part of the book, is that final chapter of my whole book, actually. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of where I kind of try to draw that section out on what the hope that Christianity offers in a world that's so filled with evil.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you mentioned, like, the very different ways people approach this, because there's a very intellectual problem of evil. Like, I have an intellectual problem because evil happened. It hasn't affected me personally, but I have a problem that evil could exist. And then there's the other people approach it very differently, where they have personally suffered.
Yeah, sure.
And it's not so much
other people suffering too.
Yeah.
How could God possibly allow that, right?
And it becomes very emotional, like death of a loved one. And
yeah,
I reject the God
of course
who would allow my loved one to die. And it's very emotional.
It is.
So those are the same problem, but from opposite angles.
That's it.
Good. And I think it's interesting that it seems like the problem of evil isn't an exclusively Christian problem.
No, it's not.
Right?
I try to talk about that. No, I hit up that big time.
Yeah. It's everyone's problem.
It's everyone's problem.
Atheists have a problem of evil, it's a different problem, right?
That's right.
I don't know if you have thoughts on that. Or
the whole chapter deals with that question, actually.
Yeah.
Just when we say good and evil exists, that sounds very simple. But I think Christianity is one of the only ones that can actually say truly that both good and evil exist, because I don't think atheism can actually say there's such thing as ultimate good and ultimate evil.
So the irony is that an atheist, for instance, is borrowing categories they can't have.
You got it.
Labeling these things good and those things evil in order to criticize the worldview that gave them those categories.
You
can't steal our categories to say that we're wrong, or that the worldview is wrong because of those categories. It just falls apart a little bit.
You got it. That's exactly what the first chapter in that section deals with.
Yeah. Okay.
I was going to say I feel out of my depth here, but that's all right. Two smart guys and me. Sitting in the room. And the last one that you dealt with, love and hell. How can a loving God send people to hell? And this is another one that's top of list with high school students, mm-hmm. especially trying to understand the judgment side of God. Because I think, I mean, I don't know where you went in it necessarily, but the sense of if you love something, the ultimate sign of love in our culture, I think a lot of people's view set is, my view is, non-judgmental.
Permissiveness.
Don't judge me. Mm-hmm. So long as you don't judge me, we can be fine. And that's often a clarifier of like, oh yeah, like not judgmental, really. Like I hear that, like as guys talk about girls they want to date, and like, oh yeah, she's not a believer, but she's not judgmental. And I was like, oh,
it's like the ultimate.
Yeah, there's still one problem with that anyway. You care to just share with us kind of how you tackled this idea of love and hell, and how a loving God can send people to hell?
Well, I think here's the great irony, Tyler, and what you just said is that we are terribly inconsistent in our culture. On the one hand, we're saying we want total permissiveness. Tolerance or freedom means no one tells us what to do. And yet then right away, we're going to turn around and say we need to tell everybody what to do when it comes to, like, recently on gay marriage.
Yeah.
We need to legislate this, and we need to make sure that everyone is correct on this. Or on a war, and when war comes up, everyone has a position. And if you want to get into the real ones, I hit up a little bit more in the chapter earlier on evil, especially do things like abuse of children or something. Of course we all have opinions on that, and we want to force those opinions on everyone else.
Everyone,
we don't actually believe at the end of the day that we want permissiveness. Really, well, when it comes down to it, the permissiveness that we want is most usually on sexuality. That's often the one that it's going to come down to. But what I try to show in the book is that we all have this innate desire for true justice to happen. And you see it all the time, and you see it everywhere. We want justice. In our culture, we want justice for the environment. We want justice for First Nations people. We want justice for the LGBTQ community. And so much of that justice and that drive for justice is right. We want it. And what I try to show is that if God is a truly loving God, he must also be a just God. A God who does not judge at all is not worthy of anyone's respect, of anyone's worship. Because he would just say, oh, I see a child getting abused or something, I'm not going to do anything about that, I just let people do whatever they want. No, nobody wants that kind of God.
Yeah.
And the great news of the Bible is God's not that kind of God. God will judge, and that judging is actually, if you start thinking about it, the most loving thing that he can possibly do. He will take care of things. He believes in good and evil, and he'll do something about it.
Well, and I think a lot of these issues that we've been talking about this afternoon, I feel like I connect them to this center point around judgment, and that we go, what often happens is that we want to put ourselves in the seat of God to make decisions for what is good and what is evil, what is right and what is wrong, who goes where and who does what, and it's kind of this, Steve's gonna laugh because it's all time, like Genesis 3, the fall of creation, like want to be like God, and this desire to make those choices.
Bart, would you say that there's a thread between these six big problems?
Dang, or that's a good question. I should
know. Or are they, like, as you studied and thought about them, at the root, or is it multiple things going on?
I think it's multiple things. Yeah. I mean, you certainly could track some of the threads. I'd say three of them have to do with God being a God of judgment. Mm-hmm. That would certainly be one that West Coast culture, of any part of North America, we are the ones who are most anti-authority. If you look at some of the studies,
in general, yeah.
Yeah, just in general, if you look at some of the spirituality studies, you know, we don't want to be under authority of anybody. So I think that's probably partly why you get that. Then we get the pluralism and the tolerance that brings in the only one way to God or homosexuality. So it's just really dealing with the main ethos of our culture today, the zeitgeist, right? The spirit of our age is one that is, don't tell me what to do, and I want to have freedom to do what I want to do, and those kind of things. And so I think probably just plays into the zeitgeist of the age.
In teaching through these in your church, in writing the book now, has there been something that maybe surprised you in your reading and in your discussions, or something that you learned through the process that really found to be significant that you'd share with us?
Yeah, I think the homosexuality one is, it's deep on my heart. Friends of mine who have same-sex attraction, reading a lot on this, and just, I've tried to be very current on all my reading. For people who say as Christians you can have same-sex relationships, people say you can't, making sure I'm really up to speed and all that. Some books I'd really recommend is like one by Wesley Hill called Washed and Waiting. He's a man who has same-sex attraction. His book is very powerful. Rosaria Butterfield's book called Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert. All his books were very helpful for me. Sam Alberry, he wrote one called Is God Anti-Gay? He is a pastor who has same-sex attraction. Reading them really helped me to understand what these people, what's their daily life, what are their struggles, and to really have empathy and to understand what's going on here. And that changes so much. I find most people who, when they're talking on that topic, when they're very aggressive, it's often because they don't know anybody who is gay. And as soon as you start to have a friend who is, or a family member, it changes the way that you deal with it. You can't just get in someone's face, and I'm not sure that you should. I don't think you should.
No.
I mean, treating people with respect on that. So those books in particular are very helpful to just get into how other people feel, how other people think. And so I commend those books to you as well.
Yeah. Well, we can't thank you enough, Barton, for taking the time out. You got your kids running around somewhere in the building, and they're probably ready to go, and it's warm back here. But we really appreciate you taking the time coming to visit with us. His book is called The Problem with Christianity. It's available, if I remember this correctly, at the website of the same name, www.theproblemwithchristianity.com.
You got it.
There's options for ordering it through Amazon. You said it's on Kindle.
Yeah, I love it if people buy directly from me. I ship anywhere in Canada, and I can do it faster than Amazon can. Amazon takes almost all the royalties, so I really appreciate it when people buy directly from me. It's through a PayPal link on the website, and I will ship it to you faster than Amazon.
Help feed some starving children.
Yeah, that's right. I have four kids.
Unemployed right now.
I am unemployed.
Help this homeless man.
We'll buy a few copies to have at the church if you'd like a copy, but... yeah, it's a treat to have you, Barton.
Thanks,
thank you for taking the time. And as always, thank you for listening to the podcast. If you have questions for us, questions on anything we talked about today, or you're hearing on a Sunday morning, send them by email to bside@tachurch.ca. Other than that, thank you for listening. And again, Barton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.